Hello, good evening. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome you to this second lecture in our three-part lecture series funded by the Leverhulme Trust on patent law, given by Professor Dan Burke from the University of California. I suspect most of you in this room need no introduction to Professor Burke's scholarship. And certainly if you were here on Friday at our first lecture, you will know that in addition to being one of the foremost patent law scholars in the world today, he also has the ability to present very complex material spanning different jurisdictions in a simple and direct way, but with a touch of drama. It gives me a great happiness then to say that today he's going to talk to us about one of the most enigmatic, even esoteric, subject matters of protection and in patent law software. So Professor Burke is going to talk for an hour or so, 6:30 to 7:30, and then we'll field questions from the audience. So,
thank you very much, and thank all of you for being here this evening for this second lecture, as you heard in the series hosted by the London School of Economics and sponsored by the Leverhulme Trust. We began this lecture series last Friday talking about gene patents, about biotechnology. We continue this evening talking about computer software and patenting. Those of you who are here on Friday will see, and for those of you who weren't here, I hope to point out some of the congruencies and parallels between those two subjects. And then Friday, March 13th, I'll try and recapitulate and sum up and maybe make some sense out of this whole area. Last Friday when we started, we first reviewed a little bit some of the justifications for the patent system, concluded that we're not really sure why we have the patent system. We hope that it gives an incentive for inventors to invest in new inventions. We hope that it gives some incentive to disclose new information, but we're not entirely sure that works all the time. Certainly there's evidence that it works differently in different industries. So as we talk about software this evening, we're talking about an industry with a very, very different type of innovation profile than biotechnology that we talked about on Friday. And we said that given the goals that we think the patent system has or the justifications that we have for the patent system, there are some criteria for patenting that, again, we hope further those goals. First of all, subject matter, which is really the core theme of this series of lectures. We only allow certain things to be patented, certain types of materials, certain types of inventions. And so much of the question that we addressed last Friday was to what extent do genes, DNA sequences, similar types of biotechnological materials fit into the patent system? Tonight we ask the same question with regard to software. But there are other criteria. An invention has to be novel. We're not going to give you 20 years of exclusive rights in return for something we already know about. Because the idea is to prompt perhaps the creation or at least the disclosure of new kinds of inventions. So the deal is you give us something new and we'll give you exclusive rights. And we don't want trivial advances over what we know or over the current state of the technology. So there's a requirement that in the United States is known as non-obviousness, really a terrible term. I kind of like the term here better, the inventive step. There has to be some significant advance over the prior art, we would say, some step forward over the state of the technology that isn't easily achieved, right? That couldn't easily be come up with on our own. So if you're an inventor and you've developed something that takes an inventive step, we'll consider giving you a patent. And then it has to be useful, we would say in the United States, utility. Other countries, including some of the ones we'll talk about tonight, couch that in terms of industrial application, but you have to be able to do something useful with it. And then you have to follow certain rules of disclosure, right? You have to tell us how to make and use the invention that you've come up with. And we're going to focus on subject matter, right? That's ostensibly the topic of the evening. But just as we saw last week, these other criteria are going to creep in, so we're going to have to keep an eye on them and remember that they are lurking on the sidelines as well. When we talked about gene patenting on Friday, we said sort of tracing some common themes through mostly common law countries, but also through the European Patent Office, looking at Canada, Australia, the United States, and some developments in the European Patent Convention, that the question of subject matter seemed in large part to be a question of how you describe or how you disclose your invention. A patent document ends with something called claims. These are statements that set out the parameters of the invention in which the applicant claims rights. You could describe a gene sequence or the subject matter of biotechnology in different ways that would seem to fit into the patent system better or worse, depending on the circumstances. We discovered that strategies that worked pretty well in Canada or the United States didn't work quite as well when we looked at the European Union. And the Court of Justice of the European Union, in one of the cases that we talked about, described genetic sequences that didn't seem to have an industrial application or weren't properly couched in the right terminology of industrial application as being mere technical information. And that's an important phrase that's going to crop up this evening and again when we meet on Friday. We said that describing biotechnological inventions, gene sequences, in particular ways, led you into problems of excluded subject matter, things that we believe don't belong in the patent system. And in particular, we ended up talking about some of the recent cases, particularly the Myriad case in the United States, where the United States Supreme Court said, we think that some of the DNA sequences that are trying to be claimed in the patent system are really things that exist in nature, products of nature, although they left us in sort of a quandary as to whether the structure of a molecule is what determines this category of products of nature, or the informational content, in other words, the function of the molecule, is what determines whether something is a product of nature. Now, all of those themes, in one way or another, are going to crop up at some point this evening, because in parallel with this ongoing quandary of gene patenting that we talked about on Friday, at about the same time and about the same places, there was a similar quandary about software. In other words, the development of patent law surrounding software and the development of problems in patent law surrounding software occurred at the same time in parallel with the gene patenting problems that we talked about on Friday. And so in some ways it shouldn't be a surprise that there are some very similar features of the software problem and the gene problem. And certainly there's dialogue between the two areas, right? The gene patenting decisions we talked about on Friday influence the software decisions, and vice versa. And I'll point out several places as we go along where that occurs. Now, in order to talk about the software cases, we have to take a step back for a moment and think about software. You know, what is software? If we're worried about whether it fits into the patent system, if we're worried about whether there are problems with fitting it into the patent system, we need to know what the subject matter is that we're talking about. And I have discovered through sad experience with my students over the years that I make certain assumptions about what they know regarding the technology and the history of the technology, which turns out to be completely incorrect. Right? So we need to step back for a minute and think for a minute about, you know, what software is, and that involves a little bit of a history lesson Some of this will be familiar to some of you. Perhaps some of it will be new to some of you. But I think the place to start is with this device, the Jacquard loom, from several hundred years ago. This was developed very cleverly in order to produce textiles with very complex weaving, very complex patterns, such as the example that you see on the picture. It's hard for a human being to keep track of all the threads and all the colors and all of the changes that have to be made in order to weave a textile of that sort. Would be very desirable to have a machine that could do it as part of the industrialization of weaving. And the device that was invented to do this, the Jacquard loom, as you can see from the illustration, did this by means of cards with holes punched in them. So as the weaving was taking place, you would advance the cards that were fastened in a series, and the needles that held the proper threads of different colors and needed to be in particular places could move through the hole if there was a hole in front of it, and were blocked from moving through the hole if there was no hole. And so you got the pattern that you wanted of threads based on the pattern of holes that allowed needles in the loom to go in and out. It's a pretty clever piece of technology. You saw a similar kind of technology with the classic player piano, right? This is one of the kinds of technology that I was sure my students would know about, because if you ever watch old Westerns, John Wayne or Jimmy Stewart, they sort of sachet, as the saying goes, sachet into the bar, and there's always a player piano playing. So this is 19th century technology. Using, in this case, a paper roll with holes punched into it, and the hole or lack of a hole would either trip a hammer or not trip a hammer. Usually there was a pneumatic device that would give us some extra force in order to depress the keys of the piano or the Nickelodeon, right? So this is an automatic playing piano. So effectively what you had was the sequence of notes, right, the sequence of keys to be depressed punched into the paper roll, encoded in the paper roll. There is, in fact, we don't want to get too far afield here, but it actually bears on our subject. There is, in fact, an early copyright case in the United States from the early 20th century, the White Music Apollo case, in which the composer of a song sued for copyright infringement because someone was distributing these paper rolls with a pattern of holes punched in them that would play one of his musical compositions, a song that he had written. And the United States Supreme Court said, well, we're very sorry, but copyright doesn't cover that. That is a piece of a machine. All right, that's like a cog in a machine. It's like if you ever looked inside of a music box, it's like the little toothed wheel where you, again, in it's kind of a similar way, have teeth or protrusions on the wheel that pluck the little tines in order to create music. That is like a cog in a machine. Copyright doesn't cover machines, sorry. Copyright covers, aesthetic things and artistic things. And so the paper roll is not part of the copyright system. It actually required legislative amendment of the Copyright Act to bring initially paper rolls and then later phonorecords and other types of musical devices into the copyright system. But clearly, you can see how this is a part of a device that, in this case, produces music. In the case of the Jacquard loom, would produce a particular pattern on a textile. Well, those two pieces of technology inspired a guy named Herman Hollerith, who was a civil servant, in essence, with a problem. The problem he was dealing with was, again, in the 19th century, trying to keep track of large numbers of immigrants, thousands of immigrants, coming into the United States in New York Harbor, Ellis Island. You know, his office was responsible for, you know, counting how many people came and what were their ages and gender and sort of other vital statistics. And it was very difficult to, record keeping for that many people. And thinking about the Jacquard loom and something like the player piano, he realized that, you know, you could ask these immigrants questions, you know, about their age and so on. And that could then be very quickly punched into a card. And you can see a little device down there in the corner that was used by the clerk for punching the information into a card. The cards then could be tabulated by a device like the one that you see on the other side of the screen with pins that would slip in and out of the holes, very much like the loom or like the player piano. And would there were counters that would keep track of how many times the pins were tripped. And so you would feed cards through the machine, and you could keep a tally of how many people came through the harbor and what their ages were and their sex and where they came from and all the other kinds of information that his office was supposed to keep track of. Holrath, by the way, went on to found a company called International Business Machines, abbreviated IBM, which you may have heard of, you know, sort of starting with this technology, right? And so you can imagine where that went. It went towards something like this, right? This is a little bit different piece of technology, right? We've now fast-forwarded several decades. This is actually ENIAC, one of the early digital computers, where the calculations that were done by the computer was actually set up by you can see the leads, the wires that were plugged into ports to effectively hardwire the computer to do certain calculations. You'll notice mostly by women. The men were all away at war, and so these early computer programmers were women, usually with mathematics or physics background. And you would set up the calculation by literally hardwiring the machine. You know, sort of embedding the software in these circuits that you could create. Other versions, early versions of the technology, you would flip a switch, right? You would set the switches on the machine in order to represent certain numbers, certain calculations that you wanted to feed into the machine. Well, became fairly clear as these calculations and the programming of these machines became more complex, that this was pretty bulky and pretty inefficient to plug these things into machines. The technology that I just showed you, right, the immigrant counting, textile weaving, piano playing technology, could be used to do the same thing. Right, you know, the reason that you're plugging these leads into connectors, the reason that you would set the switches, was to indicate one unit of information, right? One bit. It was either on or off. And the holes in the cards, the same thing, right? There's either a hole or there's not a hole, right? You can either have a pin go through the hole or not go through the hole. So as a consequence, let me jump forward one, we ended up with an era which, again, I was always sure my students would know about. They must have watched old movies or something, but none of them had ever heard of punch cards. So that's part of the reason we need to spend a little bit of time on it. Computers programmed by stacks of punch cards. Down the, you know, if you don't recognize the technology, bottom of the screen, that is a card sorter, right? The worst thing you can do when you have your program punched into cards is to drop the cards and get them out of order, right? That's really bad. So this is actually a version of Holrath's machine that will sort the cards for you, and it'll sort it in different ways, so you can get different information out of them. You see someone there punching cards, very much as the officials, the civil servants did at Ellis Island. You know, so we kept the information on these kinds of cards. Again, clearly part of a machine, right? Like the like the piano roll, it's part of a device. You don't necessarily have to do it that way, right? Remember, Charles Babbage is a difference engine. He never really got to build it because he never really had funding, but he left very detailed designs. You see an example there on the side of the picture of a modern construction from his designs of the difference engine. It actually works. And in this case, rather than flipping electrical switches or having cards that will activate electrical switches, he used gears. You know, he used toothed wheels to embed the software, right, the program for his calculations. So it's very clear that we're talking about a machine here. Hopefully it's clear that we're talking about pieces of a machine here. And that then leads us to where we need to think about software, because we're surrounded with it now, right? It's in your watch, it's in the computer projectors that I'm using, it's in the camera that's filming these proceedings, it's all around you. But very few people have an appreciation of the fact that we are talking about circuits, right, on and off, like flipping a switch or setting a wheel in Babbage's machine. And yet you get discussion in the software cases, in the patent cases, that seem almost mystical in their description of software. And that's in part because the machine has slowly faded into the background. Right? So it's disappeared, it's become ubiquitous, it's become invisible. And the on and off switches, you know, the punched cards have become invisible. We can think about software at several levels, right? A lot of times we get depictions of software like the ones and zeros over there, right? That's the on and off, right? The bits, either zero or one. And we talk about that as being machine-readable code, although really it's not, right? The machine doesn't understand ones and zeros. That's how we represent the on and off switches, which at some level are high and low voltages in a machine, right? Increasingly in a semiconductor chip embedded in some type of device. Well, it's fairly cumbersome to set on and off switches, which is why we moved to things like punch cards. It's fairly cumbersome even to work in machine-readable code, right, in binary. Humans don't work well that way. So we develop higher-level languages that can then be compiled or interpreted into machine-readable code, which then configures the semiconductor chip, configures the machine to sort of automatically change the switches. And so when you hear people talking about software, about software patents, we need to be very careful, right? Are they talking about the human-readable code? Right? I happen to pick some Fortran here, but it could be, you know, Perl or C++ or whatever. Or are they talking about the machine-readable code, which, as I said, we depict as ones and zeros, but which ultimately is some high and low voltages in a machine? Right? And hopefully what I've shown you about the punch cards and the player pianos and so on gives you a sense of the fact that we are talking about pieces of a machine, even when we're talking about the high-level human-readable code. Because we made some design choices, right, around the time of the ENIAC machine that I showed you, in part due to Alan Turing here in this country, in part due to Johnny von Neumann in the United States, that rather than having dedicated machines, right, where we hardwired them, where we plugged them to do certain things, it would be nice to have a universal machine that could be configured and reconfigured with different programs, so that the voltages, the switches, were set in different ways to do different things. But we didn't have to necessarily do it that way, right? We could have said, okay, a number of you are using laptop computers. There's a computer in front of me. They're universal machines. They can be configured to be a word processor. They can play video games. They can be a spreadsheet. They can do all kinds of different operations. We could have said, well, we're going to have dedicated machines, right? This machine will be a word processor. It will be hardwired to do that. This machine will be a video game. It will be hardwired to do that. This machine will be a spreadsheet, calculating machine. It will be hardwired to do that. We thought it would be more convenient for a variety of reasons to have flexible machines that could be reconfigured by programs. But software and hardware are interchangeable, right? Software is part of the machine. It's like the Jacquard loom cards, right? It's like the wheels in Babbage's difference engine. And so, anything you can do with software, you can do with hardware, and vice versa. There are advantages and disadvantages to swapping them out. You can understand why my friend Pam Samuelson, who ironically is speaking about this subject at this very moment at Cambridge, has described software as a machine built out of text. Right? Usually think of a machine as being built out of metal or wood or plastic or some other type of tangible material. But if you think about the levels of code that I pointed out to you, you could describe software as a machine built out of text. It then configures a piece of hardware by changing the switches, so to speak, to perform particular functions. And that is ultimately the problem, the difficulty that all of the cases I'm going to talk to you about grapple with regard to software. It is very difficult as a patent examiner, right, or as a running a patent office, and you have one fellow who walks in with this device, and you say, okay, so what is that? He says, well, this is a word processor. It is hardwired. It is wired to be a word processor. It's a new kind of word processor. It's novel. We've never had one like this before. I think I can convince you that it is non-obvious. It takes an inventive step above the previous technology. And here's my application. I've disclosed how to make and use it. And the patent office says, okay, that's like a player piano or a loom or Babbage's difference engine. It's very clearly a machine, very clearly part of the patent system. We will examine your application. A few minutes later, another guy comes in, with a disk, or a USB drive. And the patent examiner says, well, what is that? He says, well, I've got a word processor on here. Really? He says, yeah, let me show you the printout. Here's the machine-readable version. Here's the source code. Here's the human-readable version. And the examiner goes, well, that looks kind of like writing or something. It looks like some sort of symbols or script. I don't think that's really part of the patent system. Maybe you ought to go over to the copyright office. And he said, well, you just said you would examine the guy with the invention of the guy with the dedicated word processor, the hardwired one. This is the same thing. As soon as I put it into the environment, right, of a universal machine to configure the circuits, it will be, temporarily until I turn it off, a word processor with circuits that are configured, the same way that the other guy's was. It just doesn't look the same to me. So the patent office is very skeptical about this idea, but they are both machines, right? We've just made some decisions about how to depict them. So I think the place to start, where the trouble started, as with so many other things in the United States, right, in the early 1970s, with a case called Gottschalk versus Benson. This was, again, the state of the technology at the time, this type of computing. And the inventor, very much as I just described to you in my little hypothetical story, submitted to the patent office a patent application for a method of changing one kind of binary numbers into a different kind of binary numbers. Right? You know, we could get technical about it, but essentially it was a transformation of one sort of numerical notation into a different kind of numerical notation, which, you know, would be useful in a computing environment. Patent office said, no, we don't think that this is eligible for a patent. Went up through the courts to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court said, yeah, we're not comfortable with this invention of yours as being part of patentable subject matter. You see, there are a number of things that we try to keep out of the patent system, you know, that are not patentable. The first category is abstract ideas. Right? You can't get a patent on an idea. You get a patent on an embodiment of an idea, right? On an instantiation of an idea. Just sort of a pure idea, that's not patentable. And, you know, this transforming one kind of numbers into another kind of numbers, that looks to us to be pretty abstract. You haven't specified any kind of hardware here. So we think that that's one reason that your invention may not be patentable. We also don't like to patent laws of nature. The United States Supreme Court in particular likes to, you know, sort of talk about Newton and Einstein, right? You know, Newton couldn't have patented his laws of motion or gravitation. Einstein couldn't have patented general and specific relativity, right? Those are sort of out there, embedded in the fabric of the universe, and there aren't inventions, they're discoveries. And that includes, right, according to the Supreme Court, mathematics. Mathematics, the assumption here is sort of out there in the universe, waiting to be discovered, not invented by humans. Now, if this were a philosophy lecture, we could actually have a really good discussion about whether mathematics is a human invention or not. I tend to think it's a human way of describing the universe rather than something that's part of the universe. But the assumption in patent law is that it is a law, like a law of nature, right? It's like relativity or gravitation. And this transforming one kind of binary notation into another one, that looks to us like mathematics. Sorry, you can't get a patent on mathematics. Second reason why we think your invention probably isn't patentable. Third reason why we think your invention isn't patentable is we don't like patenting mental steps, right? We don't like giving patents on things that go on in people's minds for a whole variety of reasons, you know, some of them involving freedom of speech. Right? You know, like if you're thinking patented thoughts, I'm going to sue you. That doesn't seem like a good policy to have. Also, there's some practical problems of enforcement. Right, you know, are you thinking patented thoughts? And if you are, how would I know that so I could sue you? So we don't give patents on mental steps. And, it's handier to do your binary transformations in a computer, you know, but a smart person, might be able to do it with pencil and paper, or maybe somebody who's really good could do it in their head. So this looks to us like mental steps. In particular, given the state of technology at the time, right? You know, if you watch sort of old movies, you know, how do they talk about the computer? It's the electronic brain, right? You know, so sort of things that are going on in the computer that we think might be able to go on in people's minds, and we don't want to give a patent on that. And even if you're not good at doing math in your head, you might do it with a pencil and paper, and we don't give patents on what I'm going to call symbolic indicia, right? Printed matter, things that belong over in the copyright system. You know, that's why I said the patent office might be reluctant when they see your Fortran or your Perl scripts or whatever it is you're writing code in. That looks like printed matter, right? It looks like symbolic indicia. It's written by a programmer. It can be read by another programmer, and we don't give patents on things where that's the invention, right? You know, if it's sufficiently original, maybe you can get a copyright on it, but you can't get a patent on that sort of thing. And then, they didn't talk about this in Gottschalk versus Benson, but all this sort of adds up to a long-standing suspicion, right? A long-standing prejudice against so-called business methods. Now, there's never been anything at least in U.S. law, that officially says you can't patent business methods. But given that most business methods involve mathematics, mental steps, and printed matter, it's pretty rare to find one that was patentable, right? You know, so we look with great suspicion on business methods. So, you know, all these things are supposed to be excluded from the patent system. So sorry, no patent on your transformation of numbers invention. They then followed up with a couple of other cases within a couple of years. Parker versus Fluke was a case involving the calculation of an alarm limit. Now, what that meant is, you know, you have a very large chemical factory, a chemical manufacturing plant, and you have sensors that take readings of pressure and temperature and monitor that and perform calculations and will sound an alarm when the manufacturing plant is getting ready to explode. That sounds like a useful invention. The court says, nope, sorry, method of calculating alarm limits, you know, you end up with a number. You know, the output is a number. We don't think that's patentable. That's like mathematics again. Sorry, no patent. Then they decided another case, Diamond versus Deere, right? Very similar to Parker versus Fluke, involved curing rubber, right? You basically have these sort of big molds where you put, it's not actually rubber, it's, you know, synthetic polymers, into the mold. You have sensors that calculate the heat and the temperature. They use a well-known chemical equation, the Arrhenius equation, to calculate when the rubber is cooked, basically, and then the mold pops open and you get probably a tire out of it. That, they said, is patentable. You know, wait a minute, how come that was patentable and the alarm limit isn't? Well, the answer seems to be that the alarm limit calculation gives you a number, which seems to be sort of abstract and not patentable, whereas the Diamond versus Dare invention gives you a tire. Right, that's sort of a good industrial output. Right, you know, so you come up with something solid at the end of the day, that might be patentable. That then led to 30 years of consternation, right? Because very much like we talked about on Friday, with regard to biotechnology, patent attorneys said, "Well, okay, those cases make it look like we just need to describe the invention in the right way." Right? So, given what I've told you about looms and about player pianos and so on, can I describe my software as a machine? Well, sure you can, right? It's a series of states of machine as you change the high and low voltages in that semiconductor chip. So maybe I can draft my claims in terms of the state of the machine and get a patent that way. Court was unhappy about the process claims in those cases, so process didn't seem to work so well. Could I claim my software as an article of manufacture, right, which is a category of patentable subject matter in the United States? Yeah, there's a case called In re Beauregard where the inventor sent a floppy disk, essentially, to the patent office. They said, well, this is not patentable. It's a floppy disk. And the inventor said, oh, but it's not the one you know and are familiar with, right, the one off the shelf. This one is encoded with my software, so it has different magnetic flux on it than the one that came from the store. Patent office wasn't too happy about that, but they eventually took it as an article of manufacture. Right? Never seen a composition of matter claim, but the point is 30 years of patent attorneys drafting claims in such a way that they would fit into a category and didn't seem like it was too abstract, didn't seem like it was mathematics, didn't seem like it was a principle of nature in order to get around these prohibitions. Eventually, in the mid-90s, the U.S. courts, in a case called State Street Bank, said, we give up. You know, all kinds of software is getting through the patent system, through the patent office. They're just not calling it software. You know, it's a wristwatch, it's a pizza oven, you know, it's something else. We can't figure out what is and isn't software here. So as long as it produces a useful, concrete, and tangible result, taking those very metaphorically, because they said a number of numbers were patentable, you know, unlike what the Supreme Court has said in Parker versus Fluke, anything that's useful, we'll take it in the patent system. That led to all kinds of, you know, bad patents, dubious patents, ridicule of the patent system. If you're a fan of Harry Potter, you may remember that the Ministry of dubious patents is right next to the Ministry of Magic, because people were, so many weird patents got through. Eventually, the U.S. court said, well, maybe we need to be, really very tangible and concrete. If it's a machine or transforms matter, maybe that's what's patentable. Okay. We'll come back to that. In case you think this is just an American problem, I said on Friday we're going to be comparative, and we want to think about how different jurisdictions have tried to deal with this. Let's look at the European Patent Office, right, which went through the same trauma for the same period of time. The European Patent Convention, right, which is the treaty that animates the European Patent Office, Article 52, unlike the American statute or the Canadian statute that we talked about on Friday, which gives you four categories of things that are patentable, right? Machines, processes, compositions of matter, and articles of manufacture. The European Patent Convention doesn't do that. It tells you what's not patentable. What's not patentable? Well, Article 52 says discoveries, scientific theories, and mathematical methods. Oh, that sounds familiar. Right? That sounds like Gottschalk versus Benson. Aesthetic creations. Oh, that's the printed matter doctrine, right? If it should be in the copyright system, we don't want it in the patent system. Schemes, rules, and methods for performing mental acts. Ah, the mental steps doctrine. Methods for playing games or doing business. Oh, business methods. Those aren't patentable. And programs for computers are not patentable. Nor are presentations of information. You go, okay, well, that's pretty straightforward then, right? It flat out says programs for computers, not patentable, should be no problem. We know that you just don't even apply for a patent in the European Patent Office. Little problem, though, right? Article 52 says these things are not patentable as such. What does that mean? Well, nobody really knows, right? Except that apparently you can't patent a computer program as such. You can't patent a computer program as a computer program. That suggests you could patent it as something else, like a wristwatch or a pizza oven, or some other type of thing, which is what people did. So for the same 30 years that the U.S. courts were having these problems and the U.S. Patent Office was having these problems, European Patent Office was having the same problems because things were not patented as such, the applicants said. They were being patented as something else. Notice, by the way, and I said this Friday in answer to a question, very different defaults for the U.S. patent system and the European Patent Convention, right? The U.S. statute, as I just said, gives you categories of things that are patentable, but those excluded things that I talked about, abstract ideas, mental steps, printed matter, those are all judicial glosses, right? Judicial interpretations. The statute doesn't say that. Right? They've all been created by the courts through the common law process. European Patent Convention doesn't tell you what is patentable. Right, it doesn't give you categories of things that are patentable. It gives you essentially the same things that the judges in the U.S. came up with, but explicitly as things that are excluded. So the European Patent Office, as I said, spent about 30 years trying to figure out what does it mean to patent mental steps or software or whatever as such. They looked, I think somewhat unfortunately, at that section, Article 52, and said, well, what do these things have in common? Methods for business, methods for playing games, presentations of information. They said, it seems that they're not technical. It's a very unfortunate word. So they started out, saying, well, what we need to look for is a technical contribution, right? Does the claimed invention in the patent application make a technical contribution besides whatever software seems to be there, which effectively required you to decide, did the invention take an inventive step? Problem with that is that normally when you examine a patent, at least in the European Patent Office, the first question you ask is a subject matter question, right? Number one question is, does this violate Article 52? If it does, you don't go any further. You can kick it out. So you wouldn't ask normally about inventive step until later in the process, but you're asking about inventive step in order to figure out whether it was patentable subject matter, you know, the very first question. So that seemed troublesome. So they said, well, maybe that's the wrong way to think of it. Maybe the question isn't whether it makes a technical contribution. Maybe the question is whether it has a technical effect. So, you know, are the solutions or outcomes that come from this invention technical in nature? And that was as hard to figure out as the technical contribution test. And so they have more recently moved to what people have been calling the any hardware test, which is to say, if the claims of your patent application have some hardware in them, we're done. Right? You know, if there's something solid, tangible about the invention, then it is patentable subject matter, and we will then move on. So some cases like the pension benefits decision from the EPO, which, as you can imagine, dealt with a method for administering pension benefits, right? Business method. Article 52 seems to say that that can't be patentable. EPO looked at it and said, well, there is a physical apparatus recited in the claims. And so, you know, for the apparatus claims, we're going to say it's patentable subject matter. We're not happy about some other claims that have to do with methods because we think those are too intangible. But there's, you know, there's hardware in there. There's a physical apparatus. So we're done asking about physical or about subject matter. Instead, we're going to reject it on obviousness. Right? You know, sort of given the method you've developed for administering pension benefits, to implement it in essentially off-the-shelf computer hardware is pretty obvious. It doesn't take an inventive step. So sorry, no patent, but we're not going to spend a lot of time wrangling about subject matter. Another case, the Hitachi case, again dealing with a business method, right? An automated auction method. Again, they said, well, there's a physical apparatus recited in the claims, so we're done with subject matter. Your apparatus claims are subject matter. In fact, in this case, we think that the method claims are patentable subject matter. Again, we're going to reject you on inventive step. We think it's obvious to implement your method in off-the-shelf hardware. And so what they seem to have done is essentially given up on the Article 52 subject matter fight and moved to inventive step as the, where they're going to hold the line. Right? We're going to keep out bad inventions by rejecting them on inventive step, not by continuing this 30-year fight that we've had over subject matter. The EPO, at this point at least, until there's some sort of unitary patent or patent with almost unitary effect or whatever it's going to be, is composed of member states. We don't have time to look at all the things that have gone on in the various member states, although in this particular case, like so many other things in certainly in the European Patent Convention and maybe in the European Union, you get a pretty good sense of what's going on by looking at the Germans and the British. So German patent law during this period essentially went through the same gyrations, the same questions and problems that the European Patent Office was going through. In an early case called Rote Taube, they said, well, we're really looking for controllable physical forces. You know, are you controlling physical things, physical forces, and not human intellectual activity, right, mental steps doctrine? That's going to be our test for whether this is patentable subject matter or not. Yeah, it didn't seem to work too well. So then they, you know, this is sort of very German, right? It's all kind of Hegelian. So that's not working. So we're going to develop material reflection theory. What does that mean, or core theory? Well, again, it's a little bit like what I said was going on in the European Patent Office. We compare the invention to the prior art, you know, and we exclude whatever was already known and take just the core, right? And we ask whether that core inventive part makes a contribution that involves of a technical nature, that involves controlling physical forces. Yeah, that was difficult to deal with also. So then they came up with cumulative reflection theory. Right? Let's not look at the invention and try and take pieces of it away and see what the core is. Let's take the whole invention and ask, is the problem and the solution that is answered by the invention are those technical and material, right? And that gets you pretty close to something that looks like, you know, any hardware in the European Patent Office. Meanwhile, in the UK, right, the court said, well, you know, we're part of the European Patent Convention, so we're supposed to be harmonious with what's going on over there, but we also have our own law that we have to follow precedent. Long struggle to do that. The probably best known attempt, or most successful attempt, was Sir Robin Jacobs' opinion, coming up with a four-part test, a four-step test, to determine whether something is technical or not, whether it fits patent law subject matter. Number one, he says, construe the claim, you know, figure out what you're talking about. That's always a good idea. Number two, then identify the actual contribution that is made. Okay, well, that sounds a little bit like material reflection theory. Compare it to excluded subject matter, right, to the categories from Article 52 that shouldn't be part of a patent. You know, if it seems to be part of the excluded subject matter, then it shouldn't be patentable. And as a last step, check the technical nature. And he said, I'm not really sure you need to do that, but there's all this technical nature discussion in the EPO. Some later cases have suggested that maybe that last step is the same as the third step, right? But here again, the struggle is to try and harmonize what's going on under the European Patent Convention with what's going on in the law of one of the member states. All right, back to the United States then, right, you know, where this same struggle is going on. We have a sense of how the U.S. was trying to deal with it. We have a sense of how the EPO and a couple of member states were trying to deal with it. In the past few years, the United States Supreme Court has come back, and very much like Lewis Carroll's Bellman, you know, what they tell you three times must be true, right? So, you know, back in the 1970s, there were these three cases that I mentioned, right? Gottschalk versus Benson, Parker versus Fluke, and Diamond versus Deere. Now in the 2000s, three cases again, three software cases, basically. Bilski versus Kappos, Mayo versus Prometheus, and most recently, Alice Court versus CLS Bank, with a little biotech interlude that we talked about on Friday, right? In between Mayo and Alice, they went to look at gene sequences in myriad genetics. Kind of like what they did back in the 70s, right? The Chakrabarty case that I mentioned on Friday was in between the Parker versus Fluke and Diamond versus Deere cases. And I point that out, you know, that'll be important to us, particularly on Friday when we try and bring this all together, you know, that these things are happening in tandem, right? They're happening in parallel, discussion of biotech and discussion of software. Because clearly the cases that they decided back in the 70s weren't working, right? Talked about the State Street Bank case and all the consternation in the U.S. courts, at the same time as we held the consternation in the European Patent Office. And so the most recent, probably last, at least for now, and culminating decision that you may have read about or heard about is the Alice Court versus CLS Bank case. Again, a case dealing with business methods. Financial transactions involving a third-party intermediary. Right? You know, if you're sort of moving funds around electronically between different parties, there's a possibility that they can get out of synchronization so that, you know, at some point one party doesn't have enough money to resolve or pay off what it owes another party, even though the money is coming at some point. So this is a method of using a third-party intermediary to essentially hold money in escrow in order to resolve those kinds of timing problems. The application, the patent, involved method claims, apparatus claims, and claims to media, you know, that would hold this business method software. And the court said, we don't think it's patentable. We think that the way that you decide this is on the basis of a two-part test. And they started articulating this in an earlier case, the Mayo case that I mentioned, but Alice Court was where they really just kind of crystallized it. To a two-part test. Part number one, decide if the invention involves one of the prohibited categories. Sounds a little bit like Robin Jacobs' approach that I mentioned. So, you know, is it an abstract idea? Is it a mental step? Is it printed matter? Is it a law of nature? If it's one of those things, then look at the claims and decide, is there something more there than just an attempt to claim that prohibited category? Is there an inventive concept that embodies or instantiates this in some way? Again, sounds a little bit like what the European Patent Office came up with, sounds a little bit like the things we said about the UK and German approaches. Why is that interesting? Well, I said that the European Patent Office seemed to have reached a point where they said, we're not going to fight about subject matter anymore. Right? If there is any hardware, we're done with subject matter, and we're going to move on to decide whether you took an inventive step. And the test for doing that, in cases like Hitachi and pension benefits that I mentioned, is to ask, you know, would it be inventive, in American terms, would it be obvious, to implement your method in the way that you did, right? And if it's standard off-the-shelf hardware, that's, you know, that's obvious. You can't really do that, and you can't really take that approach under American law, because our statute is broken up a little bit differently, right? Section 103 deals with the question of obviousness, and obviousness is judged at the time the application was filed, right? Was the invention taken as a whole obvious to one of ordinary skill in the art at the time that the invention, the application on the invention was filed? And the one thing you are not supposed to do under American obviousness analysis is so-called hindsight reconstruction, right? You cannot assume the invention in order to assess the inventiveness of the invention. That is a, you know, logical fallacy. That's exactly what the EPO does, though, right? As I just described it to you in Hitachi or pension benefits or the Microsoft decision, if you're familiar with that decision, they say, oh, you know, given your invention, given your business method of automatic auction or administering pension benefits, would it be obvious to or inventive to implement it in the way that you did, right? That assumes the invention in order to assess its own inventiveness. Can't do that under American law. Section 103 doesn't allow you to do that. So obviousness analysis in the U.S. Would run into a barrier if you tried to do that. What has the Supreme Court done here in the U.S.? Well, they've moved something like the inventive step analysis, right? They call it inventive concept, into the subject matter inquiry. Right, so we're no longer asking about inventiveness as part of U.S. Section 103 obviousness. We're now asking about it as a one prong of a two-part test to decide if it's even patentable subject matter. And there's no hindsight reconstruction restriction on the subject matter inquiry. So they've essentially evaded that restriction by moving this inventive concept question into the subject matter analysis. You know, because a lot of people have asked, well, why are you asking about inventive concept in deciding whether it's patentable subject matter when you're going to ask about inventiveness again when you get to the 103 obviousness test? Well, the answer is there appears to be some strategic advantage to doing it earlier on as part of the obviousness inquiry. And that suggests some convergence. You know, I don't know that the U.S. Supreme Court has been reading decisions from the European Patent Office. I doubt that they would admit it if they had. Some of our justices, Justice Scalia in particular, is openly disdainful of the law of any other country contaminating United States jurisprudence. But it seems interesting that they have come to a very, very similar approach, right? We, you know, rather than fight about subject matter, let's decide subject matter by looking at the inventive step that you've taken. And the Alice case seems to be something very close to the any hardware test, right? You know, I mean, if there's any hardware in the first step of the test, then it's not an abstract idea or one of the prohibited subject matter categories. Now, when we take up the convergence of biotechnology and software on Friday, I'm going to draw some explicit parallels between what the court does in Alice and what the court did in the Myriad case, and suggest that because both of these technologies are at some level information technologies, the patent system ends up with the same kinds of quandaries dealing with them in similar ways, and that's for Friday. For now, I'm interested to hear your comments and your questions about the software puzzle. Thanks. You want me just to call
ahead.
On?
Yes, go ahead. Just you can just wait for the mic, please.
Okay.
If you're asking a question.
Or you can all go out for a drink. Yes, sir.
Did the court analysis give an indication of what the baseline should be in terms of working out what the invented concept is? Did they suggest it was the object of knowledge or a piece of RR?
No, they didn't. Now, and that's what makes it a bit of a problem, right? Because they've incorporated an inventiveness analysis into the subject matter analysis, but it is cut free from the language of the statute in the U.S. obviousness section, where we know what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to look at the prior. Now, by implication, it seems that the only way you could figure out if it's inventive is by looking at the prior art. Right? You know, how else do you know if it has an inventive concept to it? Courts are going to have to work out how that's done. My guess is that they will parallel what's been done in Section 103 and do some type of prior art analysis. But there's no timing, right? Section 103 says you must assess it as of the time of the application being filed. Section 101 that deals with subject matter doesn't tell you that. Section 103 has a person of ordinary skill standard. Section 101 doesn't. So it just has to be inventive, whatever that is. Now, as a practical matter, I can say that since the Alice decision, right, and it's only really a few months old at this point, there have been numerous challenges in court to software patents. You know, most of them were already ongoing, and when this case was decided, suddenly people began incorporating that into their arguments. Only one software invention has survived so far, right? And several dozen have been thrown out as invalid. So there's been really a wave of software patent invalidations in the courts. From the data we have available, it looks like the U.S. Patent Office, USPTO, is rejecting the vast majority of software-based applications that are coming in. The standard is pretty stringent, right? I mean, if you think about most of what you might consider innovation on the internet in digital technology, what does it involve? Well, it involves doing something on the internet that you used to do, you know, in real space or used to do with some other type of device. The court suggests in Alice that that's not inventive enough, right? Sort of implementing something, even if it's a great idea, in existing technology, not an inventive concept. Sir? It's math, right? No,
since you said that case where the numerical abstraction and changing one number to another, that's just basis for encryption. But encryption seems to fall under the embargo laws and everything like that. So it's
arms,
but it doesn't deserve to have a patent.
The most important words you learn in the law are the words. Everybody, get your pencil out. For purposes of, right? So for purposes of anti-circumvention law, we might treat encryption one way. For purposes of import-export law, we might treat the encryption a different way. The question here, right, is for purposes of patent law, how are we going to treat encryption? So let's start, you know, with Alice, right? I've got a great new encryption algorithm. I write it up and ship it off to the U.S. Patent Office. It hits the examiner's desk, and she says, "Oh, this seems to involve mathematics, which is a law of nature, and depending on how I draft this, maybe it's abstract or not, right? You know, but prohibited category fails prong one of the Alice test. Let's go to prong two, right? Is there an inventive concept? Have you implemented it in, you know, sort of off-the-shelf hardware? Well, yeah, but what else would you do, right? Going back to the earlier question, the court seems to say, if you want to develop a new type of hardware or a new system, you know, to implement your method or your mathematics or whatever, you know, that's inventive. But just using, you know, your Apple laptop or, you know, that's not inventive. So if it's meant to be implemented, you know, on the internet or on a piece of hardware we know about, that doesn't seem to pass the inventive concept test. So sorry, you're out of luck, no patent. All right, well, you know, sort of being, you know, wanting to protect all my markets, I also shipped off a application to the European Patent Office, right? You know, what did they do? Well, your claims mention some hardware. You know, you're going to do this in, you know, on an Apple laptop. Fine, you pass the any hardware test. We're done with subject matter. We're not going to worry about that anymore. Let's go to inventive step. Oh, you're implementing it in a known computer system. That's not particularly inventive. Right? So you get probably a very similar outcome to what I think you're going to get under Alice. And that's why I say, you know, I don't know that anybody in the Supreme Court was sort of reading EPO decisions, but they look suspiciously parallel. Other thoughts? They just announced, yeah, right. You can get a gold-plated one, apparently. They said they're going to have it. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
The question is this. If they produce any software for that watch, given that the watch is new, can they seek and achieve patents against that software? Because it's within the Apple Watch in their environment, physical software, as opposed to a PC like the one.
Yeah. Great question, because it draws in several of the themes that we've talked about. So the United States Supreme Court keeps saying in these cases that they don't want patents to depend upon, as they put it, the draftsman's art. You know, we don't want it to depend just on how you draft the claims. Well, that's ridiculous. Any patent attorney will tell you that everything depends on how you draft the claims. So at some level, right, what Alice means is that there is a new claims drafting game that's going to go on. Right? The first thing I'd like to do drafting the claims to software in the Apple Watch is to avoid any of the prohibited categories, you know, on the first prong. So I'm going to try and describe the watch so that it doesn't seem to involve abstract ideas, mental steps, printed matter, all those kinds of things. And talking about the hardware, talking about the watch might help that, right? If for some reason I fail that first prong, then there has to be something inventive. And as I said, we don't know exactly how inventive it has to be because we don't have a good standard yet. Having it on your wrist instead of on your lap, maybe that's inventive enough. But again, the way that you couch the claims is going to be very important, right? I mean, you know, what's actually in the guts of the watch? Is probably pretty conventional, right? There's an Intel chip or some kind of semiconductor chip that, you know, is at the basis of this. So if I draft my software claims in terms of that and I fail the first prong, you know, well, this is being implemented in a well-known piece of hardware. Maybe I don't want to talk about the type of chip that I'm going to use. Maybe I want to talk about the fact that it's physically on somebody's wrist. But that's the kind of thinking that's going on right now in commercial enterprises all over. And it's, you know, some version of it's been going on for a while in order to get past the problems in the EPL. Right? It's sort of a new game in the United States. That's something over here.
is there any chance that the inventive concept idea has more similarities with the construction of the clean step? I'm thinking particularly of.
You mean from the UK?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also the windsurfing test, where although the entire test is about inventive step, you know the. First two stages are about really understanding what the invention is or what the inventive concept is. So in that way, it might be a mere misnomer that it's called inventive concept. You know, maybe they're trying to examine something that's not really inventiveness. Mm-hmm. The second is, I wonder what you would say about the consequential reasoning that the Supreme Court is much more comfortable with compared to the EPO. At the EPO, they don't seem to ever consider what's going to be the impact of granting some of these patents. But the Supreme Court is, I think, a little bit more comfortable going into that territory.
Yeah. So those are great questions. Here's how I'm going to try and answer the first one. So my understanding from reading the UK cases and talking to Rob and Jacob a little bit is you always have to construe the claim. Right? If you don't know what you're talking about, you can't really do anything in patent law, whether you're talking about inventive step or industrial application or anything else, which is what he had in mind. But I think you're right that something very tricky is happening in the Alice analysis, because the cases that we have so far that I mentioned in answer to the previous question a moment ago, first prong, is this an abstract idea? And a number of people have complained about some of the decisions saying, well, yeah, I mean, if you ignore what's going on in the claim, anything could be abstract. Right? And in fact, this has been compared, I think, somewhat properly to some of the discussions we have in copyright, you know, the levels of abstraction discussion that we have in copyright, where ideas are not the subject matter of copyright. Only expression is. And so you have to decide, what has the infringer taken? Has she only taken an idea? That's okay. Or has she taken, the plot or taken characters or even taken text? And there seems to be a sort of levels of abstraction analysis that has to happen in the Alice test when you're looking at the claims, right? So, I have a method for, conducting an auction on the internet. Well, if I put it that way, that's pretty abstract, right? We're going to conduct an auction on the internet. If I describe it somewhat differently, again, in terms of what kind of server and client I'm going to use and, sort of how the bids are going to be communicated and the protocols and so on, that seems to be more concrete, right? And you can get increasingly concrete. And so the question is, when the judge looks at the claim, how much attention does she have to pay to the detail that's in the claim? Because you can abstract out of the claim something that is going to fail the first prong of the Alice test. And if it fails the first prong, it's almost always going to fail the second prong of not being inventive enough. So there is a claim construction question in that first prong, but it has to do with how you characterize the invention, right? Are you going to characterize it as being one of those prohibited subject matters? In particular for software, is it abstract? One thing that the United States Supreme Court may be trying to do here is to push people towards more concrete descriptions of their invention. Right? Don't tell us that you have a method of conducting an auction on the internet. Describe it in terms of the hardware. What kind of server and client and protocols are you going to use? Because those more detailed claims, of course, are going to be narrower. And maybe what they really want here is, you know, very narrow claims. Then the question about, you know, sort of outcomes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In part because of the types of institutions that we're talking about, right? I mean, in one case, we're talking about a national institution that has oversight over lower courts. And as I mentioned on Friday, a lot of what's happening in these subject matter cases is the United States Supreme Court is stepping in and chastising and you know, sort of trying to bring the Federal Circuit to heel. The Federal Circuit, of course, being the U.S. court that hears all patent appeals. So that's one thing that's happening. And yes, they're very, very concerned about sort of broad public policy implications, as opposed to an international treaty organization. My sense is, and I don't want this to sound, you know, detrimental in any way, my sense is that, you know, that the EPO actually is very, very cognizant of outcomes, but they're not part of any particular country, right, or population. I mean, they're cognizant of outcomes in the EPO, right? You know, so a lot of, you know, I mean, you know, you can sort of do an institutional analysis of EPO decisions and say, yeah, you know, I mean, this way would be good for the EPO, and this way would be not so good for the EPO, and which one did they choose? Well, it's not a big surprise that they choose the one that that works for them. But sort of not being answerable except at a very general level to the member states means that you get a very, very different different type of analysis, which is why I wanted to spend at least a minute or two on, you know, sort of what's happening in the German and UK cases. And you really do get a kind of a good set of bookends looking at the UK and Germany. There are surprisingly few other EPC states that have very well-developed software law. Right? I mean, look at France, there's nothing. But those courts are going to be thinking about things in a very different way than the EPO. That's absolutely correct, just on sort of institutional analysis. Seconds.
And thirds, I fear.
Okay.
Two for you. So basically, you've been watching this go on for a couple of years now. Where do you think it's going to go? Part one, and then part two. What is the commercial advantage to the current state of affairs?
Okay. Good questions. So, I mean, I think we have, in some sense, reached a state of equilibrium, at least. I mean, I wouldn't say clarity. You know, I think the EPO has decided what's good for the EPO and what's going to happen there. The United States Supreme Court is clearly reacting in the Alice case and in the other three cases that I mentioned, the recent ones, to problems that it perceives in the patent system. But, you know, they don't want to, you know, they've done four subject matter cases now, right, in the last 5 or 6 years. They don't want to do this anymore. So I think we've heard the last word from them on this. Lower courts are going to have to work out, as we discussed in the earlier question, exactly what this means. But clearly what it means is a lot of software patents are going to get invalidated. A lot of software applications are going to be denied. What does that mean as a practical matter, you know, sort of financially? Well, we could say two things, I think, about this. The Bilski case, which I didn't talk very much about, I just mentioned it in passing. There was an opinion by Justice Kennedy and a dissent, or kind of a concurrence dissent, by Justice Stevens. We're pretty sure that Stevens was originally going to write the opinion, you know, that what became his concurrence was going to be the majority opinion. But it was so hostile to the software industry that Kennedy, we think, got scared at the financial implications and switched sides so that we had a new majority. And he ended up writing a much milder and friendlier opinion where he said, yeah, you know, we need to be careful about this, but software is still patentable and business methods are still patentable, and you just have to make sure that they don't intrude into any of these prohibited categories. So the U.S. Supreme Court is clearly very cognizant of that in the way that we were just talking about. And the reality is, right, I think the Supreme Court was thinking about this. We have pretty good data. We have pretty good empirical data on the importance of software patents, which is they're not. So, for example, my friend Pam Samuelson, who is just finishing up her talk at Cambridge right now, was involved in a Kaufman Foundation survey of startups, you know, sort of entrepreneur small companies. One of the questions that they asked was, you know, what are the important strategies, you know, for capturing value in your industry? And with the exception of biotechnology, the answer that comes back very consistently, particularly from software, is patents are way down the list. You know, maybe number 6 or 7. Being first to market is far more important. Trade secrets are far more important. Having a good trademark, you know, branding is far more important. So why does everybody take out software patents? Well, it appears to be largely defensive, right? You know, Bill Gates, up until 1998 or so, said Microsoft will never hold software patents. They're bad. You know, they're evil. And then it became very clear that all of his rivals were building up large software patent portfolios. So now Microsoft has one too. Why? Do you make any money off of them? Probably not. You have them so when somebody else sues you, it's mutually assured destruction, right? It's the same reason we stockpile nuclear weapons, so that you can hit back with your portfolio of software patents. I think the U.S. Supreme Court was aware of that, and it's the reason they want to curtail the availability of software patents, right? Sort of like nuclear non-proliferation, because they don't seem to actually be valuable or to encourage innovation. They seem to be there, sort of as a threat or a deterrent, or maybe doing some other things, but not doing particularly good work or the kind of work we would hope that, as I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture and last time, we want the patent system to do. So I think that's kind of where we are in terms of the financial outcome. How are we doing on time?
Okay, we can take a couple of more questions. Any questions?
Yeah. She's right there. Yeah.
Will the new standard under ALICE result in more concrete claims or
better information? So I think the answer may be yes. And as I mentioned a moment ago, I think that may be what the Supreme Court intended, right? Because if I describe my invention in very broad terms, that's likely to look abstract or it's likely to look like one of the other prohibited categories. Which means I'm going to fail the first prong, as we were saying, of the ALICE test, and then I'm almost certainly going to fail the second prong. So your best defense, you know, is to think carefully as you're drafting your claims, how can I make this look very concrete, which probably means you're going to describe your invention in terms that are narrower, or at least in a different category in terms of the state of the machine or so on, as I said. So I think that's what the court was aiming for, and I think that may be the direction that things will go. There's also sort of a perverse justice or a perverse benefit here, right? In connection with what you indicated, one of the major criticisms of software patents anywhere in the world, you know, in the U.S. or under the EPC or whatever, has been inventive step or obviousness, right? You know, everybody's known how to, compile code that way for 20 years. Why did they issue a patent on it? Well, the reason they did was that nobody ever wrote it down, right? There was no prior art to show the patent examiner to say, you know, look, everybody knows how to do this compression algorithm or to write this kind of a compiler. So when it comes to the patent office, the examiner has nothing to compare it to. You know, history is kind of a blank, and so it becomes patentable. Having done that for 25 years, we now have really good prior art, right? We've issued all kinds of patents on things that were probably obvious or should have been obvious, But now it's written down in somebody's patent, and so we have perversely built up a nice library of prior art that, you know, helps us avoid broad, vague, and obvious patents from issuing in the future because we've issued broad, vague, obvious patents in the past.
Mm-hmm. Technologies. One way, particularly open source software, tries to get around this is by doing clean room implementations. So essentially, they implement the same thing without really looking at the documentation and any related kind of patent information. So when it comes to enforcement of these, would the claim hinge, when it comes to, say, defending such a case, would the the claim hinge more on, of the prosecution hinge more on the outcome of said patent, or how the patent is implemented? And additionally, are you familiar with any cases where these clean room implementations have been tried in court?
Yeah. So, so clean room implementations doesn't really help you in the patent space. What clean room is intended to do is to avoid copyright infringement. Right. Patents have the benefit or detriment, depending on your view, of applying to independent creation. Right? So even if I have never seen your invention, never seen your code, and I come up with something that falls within the scope of your patent, I'm still liable. Right? Not true in copyright. In copyright, you have to copy. Right? And so the point of a clean room exercise is to be able to prove that my engineers never saw your code, and if they came up with something that looks like your code, that's just because, you know, that's the only way to do that particular algorithm or that particular routine, and I can show you that no copying occurred. There are some cases that deal with clean room implementations. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, because it's awfully, awfully hard, you know, to actually document and prove, you know, like, yeah, you know, your code looks just like Microsoft Office, and we're, you know, my engineers never saw Microsoft Office. Never? Really? I mean, you can sort of show that when they were writing the program, perhaps, but never at any time. So if it's something that's in wide circulation, sometimes that approach fails. And that's all because, actually going back to the piano rules that I mentioned, I mean, you know, we're in a very odd situation where software is one of the few items of intellectual property that is both subject to the copyright system and subject to the patent system. After Gottschalk versus Benson in the United States, I said that's where a lot of the trouble started. The software industry ran to the U.S. Congress, and then later on this got into international treaties and said, look, we can't get patents on software, so you better give us copyright protection, right? Which then leads to the avoidance of copying, you know, and the clean room kind of techniques. But even if you use a clean room and you follow through somebody's patent claims, you're still in trouble. Right?
We have the final question.
Final question.
Yes.
Sir.
I have a question regarding startups and patents. So would you advise a startup, right, technology software to apply earlier on for a patent given the so-called patent rules? Because you know what I'm talking about, right? Patent trolls.
Oh, trolls, yeah. So, since you said the word advise, I will start this, you know, with a disclaimer that I am not admitted to practice in the UK. I am not your lawyer. None of what I say is legal advice. Not entirely clear to me why applying for a patent would subject you to patent trolls. Right? Patent trolls are typically, or so-called non-practicing entities or patent assertion entities, have gone out and scooped up lots of patents, right? And they're watching for startups. And they typically don't care whether you have a patent or not, right? If they think you're doing something that falls within something within in their portfolio, a patent within their portfolio, they're likely to come after you for some type of a settlement, right? Because the strategy is, in particular for startups, right? Patent litigation is very, very expensive, right? And if it's going to cost you, you know, £500,000 to start to defend a patent suit, I'll settle for $250, right? And if I do that often enough, you know, it's cheaper than even defending the lawsuit for all these new startups, and I extract, you know, £250,000 from each of them, I can make a pretty good living that way, right? So what they're really watching for is any kind of activity, right, that they think falls within their patent portfolio. They are typically not concerned about whether you have a patent or not, in part because patents can overlap, right? And then you just exclude each other. So if I understood the question correctly, I think they're going to come after you regardless.
Well, that seems to be a great note to end the lecture on. I'd like to thank Professor Burke for his fascinating insights into convergence and also for his great audience interaction. So thank you.
Thank you.